So they switched from hand power to
Yeah, steam
steam
power.
power.
Our water supply was, well, they had an 80-foot well dug into the hillside. It was dug by hand, you know, it wasn't drilled. Like a big old prospect hole, and it was operated by a Fairbanks Morse windmill. There's quite a bit of wind in that country, and they had water tanks underground, keep from freezing, as a reserve water supply. So even the windmill wasn't running,
There's always
there
some
was always some
on
supply,
hand.
and the water was real good. I never heard of anybody getting sick, and I never heard of it being tested or anything else, but it was good water. And later on, they got spring water. There was a little creek there, and they found out that the spring was high enough that it could be fed into their holding tank by gravity. So they didn't have to use the windmill, at least much in the summer anyway, as far as I know. But that was some of the softest water I've ever seen. You just touch a bar of soap to your hands and wash it and that, and it's just lathered. I've never seen anything lather so nice with so little soap. It's really the softest water I've ever seen on the Yukon, at least in the bush.
Yeah, hard water is usually the
It
problem
was a
in most
natural
places.
spring, yeah. See, the steamboats that were running at the time when I was down there was the Alaska Railroad River boat by the name of the General J.W. Jacobs. And Jefferson Davis. And between the two, one was going down the river and the other was coming back.
So they'd make a trip
About
in there about
every two
2 weeks
weeks, yeah. About every 2 weeks they
during the
would,
summer.
yeah. Until, that was until 1933. In 1933, they built the steamer Nenana the year before, and it made its maiden voyage down the Yukon in the spring of 1933. Then my oldest brother Adolf was one of the firemen on it.
Oh, so he knew
Yeah,
Captain Adams.
he fired on the boiler there for 4 years. Until he moved to Fairbanks in 1936, and then he gave up the navigation.
Did you ever travel on the Nenana?
Yeah, I made one trip on the Nenana in 1936 as a mess boy, but I'll tell you what, I couldn't take the heat because being a mess boy, you had to wash all the dishes and all the pots and pans, and the coal-fired stove was right across from you, and it was so hot, I was just sweating for 2 weeks, and I didn't want that kind of a lifestyle. So I only made one trip. That was two weeks. It was a 2 weeks trip. That was my experience working on the steamer Nenana. But let's see. Oh, I guess we ain't got out of Holy Cross yet, but I was down there in 1928 when the first airplane arrived.
Oh, who was the pilot?
I'd say, well, the company was primarily owned by, Rodabaugh. Have you heard of
Oh,
Rodabaugh?
yes.
I think it,
Jimmy Rodabaugh, I think
yeah,
is his
Jimmy
name.
Rodabaugh, I knew him too. I think it was a partnership deal, but he was the main push behind it.
So that's where your interest in planes
Yeah,
got started.
anyway, and their number one pilot was A.A. Bennett. He was a big, tall, lanky guy that, anyway, he flew the first airplane down to Holy Cross. He'd hauled one of the brothers down from Fairbanks that had missed the last boat, you know, in the latter part of September, because the last boat would come, would leave Holy Cross about the middle of September, and they had to get back to Nenana before it froze up, and then they were pulled up out of the water, you know, and beached. Anyway, he came down with his brother Heaney was his name, and that was the first airplane. It was a five-place Zenith biplane with a four-place enclosed cabin up front and an open cockpit in the rear, like I got on the wall.
Oh, like the one on the...
Yeah, sat out in the back. I understand from talking to old Jim Hutchison that it had a 220-horse right whirlwind engine on his nine-cylinder. He hand-propped it. And
so that means getting out in front and cranking it?
He cranked it by hand, yeah.
That's pretty dangerous.
He was well experienced. He was a big, tall, husky guy, and he'd hand prop the darn thing. And then in the cold weather, he'd run around the back end, pull out his reindeer coveralls. He used to have big pilots in those days, a lot more high mucklucks way up to their knees in case they had to jump out in the snow, you know, in cold weather. And he wore this reindeer suit, like a pair of coveralls, you slip it over.
Carhartts.
Yeah.
And the reindeer.
No Carhartts then, and he'd crawl in the open cockpit, and that was about an 80-mile-an-hour airplane. It was a real speedball, you know. And they tell me his emergency gear was a rifle and a bottle of whiskey. That's the way the story goes, and I never heard it any different. He was a tough old guy.
This was A.J. Bennett, or
A.A. Bennett.
Or A.A. Bennett.
Yeah. Their company sold out to Eielson.
Oh, Ben Eielson.
Ben Eielson in 1929, and Bennett left Alaska, moved to Idaho.
So Eielson came in through Holy Cross on
a case? Eielson didn't know, Eielson bought their company. Mm-hmm. Ben Eielson bought the company, and Rhoda Baugh sold out. Bennett was a hired pilot, you know. There were others owners in it. I couldn't tell you who without looking it up. I think Dick Wood was one of the owners, and offhand.
So you really saw the beginning of the airplane age.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Being there in Holy Cross to the demise of long distance.
That's the
dog sled travel and.
Let's see, the second airplane down there was flown by Thomas Girard. He came down there to pick up the wireless operator in November of 1928. And that one was I guess they called it a Stinson Detroiter. It was the first one of the first cabin airplanes to ever be flown in Alaska. One of the first.
They're all
a four-place cabin plane, not an open cockpit.
They all started out as open cockpits.
Yeah, yeah. or mixed, you know, open cockpit
and with
the closed cabin up front. But anyway, he flew down there November that same year, and pick up the wireless operator to take him to Fairbanks for medical attention, and by golly, he crashed on takeoff. The airplane veered to the left and hit the brush, and he came straight down on his nose. But he wasn't over 15 feet in the air.
So he wasn't
skis
hurt.
Skis caught in the brush and came straight down on his nose, and he spent the whole winter rebuilding the airplane and flew it back to Fairbanks in spring of 29. But anyway, that was my first
In the meantime, how did the
first experience of seeing an airplane crash?
And the wireless operator that needed help, health care?
Oh, this old A.A. Bennett came down with his open cockpit plane and rescued him. They was the same company.
So he did get out after all.
Yeah. Because he was a wireless operator. He could send a message too, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
They weren't hurt. They were just had to spend the whole winter there, though, fixing the plane up.
Yeah. I guess that happened to quite a few people.
Yeah.
Wherever you crashed, you
and then
fixed it on the
spot. Next experience, of course, with airplanes was with Brother Feltus, you know, flew the first diesel-powered plane into Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
They shipped it. Well, he flew it from Long Island to San Francisco, to Seattle. Anyway, this diesel-powered airplane, it was donated to the Catholic Missions, the Bishop of Alaska, by called the Marquette League, I guess, in Illinois. I guess it was a Catholic league. And the Packard Motor Company donated the 225-horse Packard diesel engine. Anyway, he flew this airplane from Long Island, New York, to San Francisco, Seattle, and then shipped to Fairbanks, and they assembled it here in Fairbanks and the latter part of September of 1930. They flew it down to Brother Feltus and, let's see, Brother Feltus and Father DeLon, and they had one of the boys that was to reside at Holy Cross as an extra passenger. And they flew up from Fairbanks to Holy Cross. And Ralph Wien, they hired Ralph Wien as a co-pilot to kind of show Brother Feltus around because he was brand new to Alaska, you know. You've heard of Ralph mm-hmm. Wien, of course. He was the older brother of Noel Wien. Anyway, I saw the airplane actually in flight, four different flights. In the end of September, Brother Feltus and Ralph Wien with Father DeLon and another priest by the name of Father Post. They flew from Holy Cross to Nome, to Pilgrim Springs, and then to Kotzebue. And on October 12th, 1930, they were prepared to come back, the return trip to Holy Cross. And they'd warmed the airplane up and all that, and then they decided, well, the snowstorm was blowing in, so Brother Feltus let Ralph Wien take the plane up to show the local priest there by the name of Father Walsh, show him the country from the air. And from the story I got from Brother Feltus, he stood on the ground watching the whole show. And Ralph, the airstrip there was only about 750 feet long, so Ralph Wien came down for the first approach and overshot the field. Then he went around and he came down the second time. Again, he overshot the airstrip. Then he climbed out for the third approach, and when he got about 400 feet high, he made a turn, nose high, a steep bank, nose high, and come straight down on his nose. And when he got about 40 feet from the ground, he gave her a full throttle and just plowed the engine into the ground about a foot deep, and the airplane stopped straight into the ground with the wings level with the ground, even with the leading edges, you know. He just made mush out of all three of them.
So that was Father Walsh and...
Father DeLon, Father Walsh and Ralph Wien, but no fire. The amazing thing. With that diesel engine, no fire.
It is amazing.
You know, if I'd been a gas engine, you'd have had a fire bomb.
Mm-hmm.
I've always been kind of partial to diesels ever since, too.
Yeah. So how much longer did you stay then at the mission?
I left there in the latter part of April in 1935 and moved to Anchorage. You know, that's where my brother was wintering. See, he was a fireman on the steamer in Enon, and he'd winter in Anchorage, which was a railroad center.
Mm-hmm. This is Adolf.
Yeah, older. He's 2 years older than I. So I moved to Anchorage, and then in the spring, when the things start moving, the railroad construction jobs and all that start. See, the railroad, they'd have a construction program every summer. Bridge repairs, railroad bridge.
A lot of maintenance work.
And I hired out with a cook on a bridge gang, a 16-man crew, for $60 a month, board and room. Big pay.
This is during the Depression, so that was probably...
That was 35, yeah.
Good wages.
I stayed with the railroad. Then I also got on a, what you call an extra gang. I worked at the Curry Hotel for a while.
That was the overnight stop for passengers.
Yeah, I worked there for a while as a mess boy. And I was pretty young. They figured I was too young for me to accept a hard job. They always say, go down there and see the steward. So I could always get a flunky job, but nobody wanted to give me a tough job. But anyway, for the 4th of July in 1937, I moved to Fairbanks. It's been my home ever since.
Yes.
But 4 days after I got to Fairbanks, Mrs. Bayless that I knew in Enana, she had lined up a job for me because she knew the foreman and his wife that were running the operation on Eagle Creek, the mining camp on Eagle Creek off the Eagle Summit. You've been up there.
Mm-hmm.
That's Eagle Creek down on the right, you know.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
And I got a job there on the 8th of July, 1937, working 12 hours a day, picking bedrock, breaking rock, hauling rock, tending the sluice boxes, once in a while running a hydraulic joint. We had no bulldozers in those days.
So
we had a little Caterpillar 28 tractor for moving the heavier giant and the pipe around and the boxes and stuff like that. Little 28 gas cat, and that was all, but no dozers, but everything was manual. We did all the sluicing, all the dirt moving with the hydraulic giants.
So very much the same type of operation as your dad did in Rampart.
Yeah, and on Eagle Creek at that time, of course we could only sluice when we had water. And usually there was a dry spell every summer, maybe a month, about the middle of the summer. But we used to pipe in the dirt from the front and from the sides also, over the sides of the boxes, which was unusual for most mining operations, to pipe over the side, and you'd hit it, deflect the dirt against a swinging plate, and the dirt, pay dirt, would go down into the boxes that way. Otherwise, if you didn't have that, it would just go out over the top. And we had, if I remember right, we had up to 9 hydraulic giants set up.
Pretty good sized operation.
We could move them around. Well, it wasn't that weird about an 8-man crew, but we were always moving those giants. There's a lot of bulwark, tell you, and pulling pipe, and driving pipe. There's a lot of, just all manual labor. And I'll tell you what, when we worked 12 hours a day, there was no goofing off. There was no break. There was no goofing off. There was no breaks. If you didn't perform, you got your paycheck after breakfast the next morning, and you figured out how to get home. There was nobody pampering you, and there was no federal regulations that saying up.
It was a long hike back.
The federal regulations. Yeah, so did they telling your employer how to get you home?
What company was it? A company?
It was a Berry Holding Company.
Oh, yeah. Clarence Berry.
Yeah. I worked there. 37. I worked there. Actually, the last year I was worked there to 41, but in 38 I worked for Zimmerman, running a hydraulic giant over on Independence Creek near Miller House, in the Circle District. And then 1941, I worked for Zimmerman. Then I also worked on sourdough for him. He moved me over there because I was running the hydraulic giant for him over there.
Where is sourdough?
That's about, it was 67 miles out on the Steese Highway at the time. I think it's around.
So the Circle District.
Well, it's in the Chattanooga Valley. It's on this side of Eagle Summit.
Oh, so it would be
on this side of 12 Mile Summit, Sourdough Creek. Yeah.
Oh, I think I know where that is.
Yeah, there's a little camp there. I worked there. Then I went the following year. I went back to Eagle Creek, and in the last year there, or in 1941, I worked for the Central Mining Company on Deadwood, running a DA cat that year, but I didn't stay the whole year. I went back to Eagle Creek the latter month or so of the year, and that was my last year in mining.
I was going to say, with the outbreak of the war, that shut down gold mining in World War II.
That was the last year that I mined it, that I worked in the Circle District, because the following year, that winter I worked, I got married that year in Seattle, in Tacoma to Martha in 1941. And that year I stayed home, I didn't go outside. So I worked for the old Thrifty Market.
Grocery?
As a delivery boy that winter. And then in the spring of 40, a lot of the employees of the old FE company were no longer around. You know, they were being drafted or volunteered for World War II. So I hired out running the dozer out there on Cripple Creek for the FE company, and my main occupational job there was to build roads for that 12-yard Bucyrus Monaghan drag line that walked. And it took a 60-foot road to walk, and you had to be pretty, your road had to be level, you know. Mm-hmm. It took.
What is this drag line for?
It was Bucyrus Monaghan, but they were stripping for the dredge. The ground was so deep, they were stripping.
Oh, out by Esther.
Yeah, and then running the overburden off with a conveyor. On conveyor with a hopper, this drag line was stripping was excavating the stripping material and dumping it into a big hopper that fed it into a conveyor, and everything was run by electric. The drag line was electric, and so was the conveyor. And my job was to keep the road for that drag line maintained, and also for laying the conveyor out. I had to build the roads for that too, build the grades. And then after, when the stripping came off the end of the conveyor, it was my job to keep pushing it over the bank,
mm-hmm.
you know, keep it from bunching up at the end of the conveyor. I had to keep pushing it over the edge. So I worked there till, I worked there the summer of 42, and then in, I believe the end of August of 42, I hired out for the U.S. Army engineers out at Ladd Field. I heard there was an opening there, a job opening, and as a civilian. A friend of mine told me about the job, and I hired out there because that guaranteed me a winter job, actually a year-round job.
Year-round job. I guess that was really tough for a lot of people.
Anyway, I worked out there. We were working on I was running a D8 dozer and a scraper and all that construction equipment and building up the runway. There was only one runway there at the time, 5,000 foot runway, and we extended each end about 2,000 feet to build it up to about 9,000 feet or something. That was a long runway, and then another runway next to it, about 7,000 feet, and then all the taxiways and the building hangar sites and all that. So there was lots of dirt work to do, and there was old sloughs to excavate and fill in and all that. So there was a lot of that road building. So
there was a lot of dirt.
I worked out there till I got drafted in January of 1944. This was from August of 42 to January of 44. And I got drafted, and when I got drafted, there were eight of us drafted at the same time, and Joe Vogler. That's where I met Joe Vogler.
Oh, is that where I was going to say?
That's
where did you meet Joe?
That's where I met Joe Vogler. We flew down to Anchorage with the old Star Airlines, Star Airways. That was a forerunner to the Alaska Airlines. They had a big 10-passenger Pilgrim airplane. And I understand it's the last one in existence today in the museum in Anchorage. And we flew down to Anchorage on that Pilgrim and landed at Merrill Field. Of course, the military picked us up, and we were escorted to a Quonset hut. That was it was heated with an oil stove. That's all they had. It was a training area for recruits, you know. And there's where I met Joe Vogler. We were both assigned to the same hut. And he didn't hesitate to tell us what he thought of President Roosevelt. And some guy, we thought he was pretty radical at first. But he got wind that, he was in Texas at the time, he got wind that the Pearl Harbor incident had been planned. Pearl Harbor attack had been planned. And of course he hated Roosevelt anyway because he was a socialist, you know. And Joe Vogler didn't like his programs too well. So anyway, when his turn came to be interviewed by the recruiter, he told them on no uncertain terms what he thought of President Roosevelt. He said, "You can't talk about our president that way." And Joe Vogler says, "The hell I can't. He's a dirty communist son of a bitch." Anyway, Joe was a little too rough on the recruiters. They turned him loose. They figured they couldn't handle him. But they took me. Joe was pretty well, you know, he was educated, pretty well informed, but At my age, I was young and trusting. I kind of looked at our president with a kind of a father attitude, and it never occurred to me a president or his cabinet would pull a trick like that, you know, to plan like Pearl Harbor attack. Of course, I found out later it was not only planned, but it was the big disappointment was that it didn't turn out like Custer's last stand. But I found that out much later.
Mm.
But Joe Vogler was 100% right, there's no question about it. But he was, it was the wrong time to express his views when everybody was gung-ho, America first, and we have to defeat Hitler, we have to defeat the Japs, which, well, I guess we got involved with Japan, we had to finish it. I was drafted in the Army I took my training in Anchorage, and then I put the rest of my career here in
service here
in Fairbanks. Yeah, I worked in construction the summer of '44, and then that fall I transferred to the ordnance out at 6 Mile. Mm-hmm. Right out here at the Badger Road, 6 Mile where the surplus is, and I worked in that shop for 20 months. Until June of 46, when I got the discharge. After I got discharged from the Army, I went to work for Carrington, the old Glenn Carrington Company. I don't know if you heard of mm-hmm. them or not. I worked for them as a parts man for a couple of years, and then worked another couple of years for the Road Commission. I wanted to change occupation. What I was looking for experience in different things. Then I worked for the contractors a while in '51. Then I went back to Carrington.
All the time you were able to stay right in Fairbanks.
My boss asked me to come back, and then I worked, in the fall of '51. So I worked there till, end of '53. Then I hired out they got a little short of work there. We were pretty dead in the winter. So I hired out at Ladd Field in January of '54.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it switched over to as a mechanic, I hired out as a heavy equipment mechanic, but frequently we had to work on cars and all kind of different types of equipment, little tractors, lawn mowers, these mowers that they used to cut the grass and maintain, snow plows, graders, and all that kind of stuff. And regular construction equipment. It was construction equipment.
But it kept you employed.
And roads and grounds maintenance equipment, fire equipment, and all that. A lot of pickups and military trucks. We had a variety. We had a large variety of different types of equipment to work on, from cars, trucks, gas and diesel engines of all different sizes. So I got a lot of experience there. I had a chance to retire in June of '72, so I did. And then from then I went full-time mining out there at up by Eureka with my boys. But up until then I was just mining out there in my vacation. Just small operation mm-hmm. with the boys, because I staked the ground with old Red Anderson. I don't know if you knew who he was,
mm-hmm.
old Red Anderson. He was an old timer that used to live at Rampart. He knew the family, and he asked me if I'd go out there to Omega Creek. He said he wanted to stake some ground, but he loved to get out in summertime.
So he knew your family
yeah,
when you lived in Rampart.
Rampart, yeah. He gave me a call one day, and he says, I want to show you a creek out by Eureka. So I drove out there. I said, well, I might as well go out there and take a look at it. It's just nothing serious to get excited about. So I'd never driven much of that area before. I'd only been to one mining operation. And he was showing me some new ground, new areas. And I'd heard about the history of the creek, so I wanted to see it for myself, because the Miskoviches used to mine there. And I wanted to see what was left. So I went out there, and we staked four association claims. That's 660 by 2640. Four association claims. Found out later it was federal land. It still is. I'm still holding the ground. But then, let's see, we went out there in August of 65, and then the summer of 66, all we had was a little, I had a little D4 cat. I could strip, and then we cut most of the trees and brush by hand. Old Red was a hard worker. He was 77 years.
I was going to say he must have been getting up there in years that point.
He came into Alaska in 1910 pulling a sled with two other guys out of Valdez. And his friends dropped off at Esther, and he said he chopped the sled in two and then pulled it the rest of the way over to Eureka by himself and got snowblind spring of the year. And he mined over there a lot through the years, the Eureka, Manly, Rampart area and all that. He's a tough old Swede, I tell you.
Did you remember him when you were a child?
Yeah, I remember his name.
But you don't remember him then?
Yeah, I couldn't remember. He was one of these guys that, I don't want to say anything uncomplimentary about him, but he was a tough old guy. His pipe was always in his mouth, and by golly, that old guy could handle his booze. He could handle it well.
That's why he never froze.
Well, anyway, they put him in the Pioneer Home, and he cashed in at 94. So he never did give up, as far as I know. He's smoking a booze habit. He was the best good-natured old partner I ever had. I liked him. He was a lot of fun. He could tell a lot of stories. But he didn't want to mine. He really didn't want to mine. He built a cabin there out of an old cabin, and then I bought him out in the spring, early summer of 67. And, 67. So then I mined out there in my spare time up until 1990, until 72, with my two boys.
Mm-hmm. Because you were still working full-time.
Yeah, I was still
time,
working,
so.
But, I'd get 20 days a year, annual leave, and all that.
So that was your vacation?
Yeah, well, I was preparing it for my retirement, when I wanted to go back to mining when I retired, which I did in 72. And of course, I had a shutdown in 85 because of all these environmental regulations. Right. And I was on federal ground at the time, and what really shut me down was the environmental lawsuit. They got four native villages and three environmental organizations, seven different outfits launched this lawsuit against the EPA for not enforcing the strict regulations. So, right in the spring of the year, and we were going to go mining, so I told the one son of mine, you better look for, and it sounded like they were going to be tied up quite a while, so we couldn't operate, so I told him, you better go look you better go look for another job. I says, even if you got to take somebody else's job, you better try to keep employed. So that really shut us down because I didn't want to. I only had the other boy, but I didn't want to set up in mine while the lawsuit was on because I didn't know what the outcome was going to be. And then there was always a threat of fines, you know, $10,000 a day for dirtying the water and all that. So
the land was in dispute then?
Yeah.
Being that it was federal land?
Yeah, so we mined just a little bit the next year after we were settled, but the threat was over our head, and I shut down in 1985.
You said the suit was settled. How was it settled? What were the terms?
Well,
you could mine, but with
certain restrictions. Yeah, at that time it was tied up. We couldn't legally mine while it was tied up. But the suit had been settled later the summer of 84.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time we couldn't legally mine while the suit was on